King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be immediately cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall be immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. These men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like the son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of these men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
What does it mean to be free? So according to numerous sociologists and people that write about that kind of stuff, freedom in our society, in our culture, has become the ultimate good. This is the ultimate good of American society. It's freedom. It's the fundamental core of our culture. But freedom, of course, has changed its definition. It has come to be defined as the absence of any limitations and constraints on us. Charles Taylor, in his seminal book, A Secular Age, he actually has a quote of somebody else that I'm going to read to you, but Alan Ehrenhalt. He discusses the modern view of freedom, and this is what he says: let each person do their own thing, and one shouldn't criticize the other's values because they have a right to live their own life as you do. The only sin which is not tolerated is intolerance. So in other words, there's intolerance of intolerance. Whatever, does that make sense? There's intolerance of intolerance. So what does that have to do with our passage? There are a lot of things we could discuss in this passage. We could talk about the faith of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We could talk about the evils of the corruption of absolute power with Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, we could go down lots of roads in this passage. But what struck me here this time is the absolute freedom of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They have to go against what is a very dangerous situation for them, but they strike me as being completely free, completely free. So why is that? Well, that's what I want to look at today in just 2 points. The first point is Nebuchadnezzar's bondage, and the second point is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's freedom. So Nebuchadnezzar's bondage, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's freedom. It's a mouthful. All right, so let's look at Nebuchadnezzar's bondage. Babylon was a pluralistic society, much like we are today. They had any number of gods. No one cared which god you worshipped. If you had another god and you brought it to the society, very welcome. You worship that god, no problem. All gods were welcome. You do you, believe what you want, worship the god you want. Complete tolerance, complete ability to embrace any god whatsoever, which isn't different from today. You do you. You believe what you want to believe. Don't tell me what I need to believe. We all believe whatever. But there was a problem here in Babylon. The Jews that had been brought from into exile into Babylon, the Jews believed in the exclusivity of one God to the exclusion of all others. And that's where the problem begins. You can believe in any God you want, but you can't say that your God is the only one or the only true one. So they believe in the exclusivity of one God, and that's a dicey proposition in Babylon. Why? Because Nebuchadnezzar had made an image of gold. But there was a difference with his image of gold. He was fine if you worshiped your own God, but he was insisting that everyone had to worship his God as well. You can worship any God you want, but you also had to worship his God. It's much like Rome was. It's much like all totalitarian regimes. Believe what you want, but you must bow down before the absolute ruler. In Rome, the emperor was God. But here Nebuchadnezzar raised his own statue and insisted that they must bow down. When you hear the music play, no matter what you're doing, you need to stop and bow down. So that's actually intolerance of intolerance. So they're accusing the Jews of being intolerant, and they won't be tolerant of the intolerance. No one is allowed to believe in exclusivity, that your God is the only God. If you believed in a God, he was one of many, and you had no right to say that yours was the only God. Okay. I don't think it's any different today, right? We're in the same situation. People get very angry about the exclusive claims of Christianity. That we believe that Jesus is the only way to the Father, that there's only one God in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. The mantra today is that you can believe in whatever you want to believe in. You can believe in whatever God you want to believe in whatever system, whatever thing you want to believe in, but you're not allowed to reject someone else's position. That's hate, and that's not tolerated. But here's my question, and I say this with all the respect I can muster. Who is really the intolerant one? Who is really the intolerant one? So the center of Christianity is God on the cross. And what is he doing on the cross? He is praying for his enemies. He is not rejecting his enemies. He's asking God to forgive his enemies. That's hardly an intolerant position that he's in. That's actually tolerance. Dying for people while they are still sinners, or they're still rejecting him. That's why he went to a cross. It's actually tolerance. And yet our secular society is completely intolerant of what they perceive as a religion of intolerance. But if you are intolerant of intolerance, aren't you just intolerant also? Is that too much wordplay there? Anne said, when she read this, I'm not supposed to say her name anymore. Sorry. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I just can't get it right today. I won't say any more about that. Ask me later. Oh, my word. All right. Isn't that just intolerance of intolerance, right? That's what that is. So I would argue today that Christians are more tolerant than our secular culture. It's deeply embedded in what it means to be a Christian. But what I want to get to here is that intolerance of intolerance is actually bondage. It's not freedom. It's actually bondage. It's not freedom. It generates anger. It generates reaction. What's interesting is that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not trying to make a statement. We're not going to do it, and we're going to stand up, and we're going to lead as many people as we can not to do this. That's not what they were doing at all. As far as we can tell, they were not trying to stand up against anything. They were over in the corner somewhere. They were not trying to make a big deal out of this. Look at our text in verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. It's almost as if they were making up a story about them. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And so what does the king do? Intolerance of intolerance, right? Then Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon." I don't know what a trigon is, but I've been asking myself that. I should have researched it. But anyway, it might be interesting. "Harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made. Well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Here's the thing about freedom. There are two kinds of freedom that philosophers talk about. The freedom that comes from the Enlightenment is completely negative. It's called negative freedom. And why is it negative? It is a freedom from all restraints. Anything that would push you to do anything, you negate that. That's why there's a questioning of authority. There's a question of anybody over you, anybody telling you what to do. Real freedom is freedom from all restraint. But the biblical view of freedom is opposite. It's called positive freedom. And positive freedom means that you are free when you have been released to be truly who you were built to be. That's positive freedom, when you're released to be who you were truly built to be. One is, anybody pushing on you, you can reject it. It's negative freedom. Any restraint you can get rid of. Positive freedom is you can be who God made you to be, or who you were built to be. So clearly, from a secular point of view, Nebuchadnezzar was the most free person in the entire society. And why do I say that? Well, he was the totalitarian dictator of everything that happened. He could do whatever he wanted. He could wipe out anyone. He could come and go as he pleased. He could use and abuse people without any repercussions. He had no hindrances whatsoever, and was what our secular culture would call truly free. By any stretch, by any definition in our culture of freedom, Nebuchadnezzar must have been the most free person that ever existed, or at least alongside of other totalitarian rulers. But was he? Was he really free? Well, no. He was an absolute slave to his passions and his anger. Actually, he was a slave to his insecurities. So, in order, we talked about this a little bit last week, in order to conquer other nations, what Nebuchadnezzar would do, he would bring exiled people to Babylon and educate them in Babylonian culture, and that would include, and he was fine with their having their own gods. That was a way of having them continue in their familiar patterns of worship to their own gods. You worship whatever god. There's just one little itty-bitty exception. You have to bow down to the god I give you. That's the one place where you've got to do this. This was the way he could conquer other rulers. They had to bow down. And here's the thing about totalitarianism, right? It breeds insecurity because there's always the threat of overthrow. So he was completely free from all restraints. But in order to maintain that kind of freedom, he would have to squash any even remote possibility of an overthrow, of a conspiracy, of anything. And this is where you get your people to go throughout the society and listen in, and you squash it. You have to squash it. I read somewhere that Stalin didn't sleep in the same bed twice, at least not two nights in a row. He would move around from many residences to many bedrooms. Why? He was afraid of assassination. Does that sound like freedom to you? That doesn't sound like freedom to me. So in order to remain in power, Nebuchadnezzar has to threaten disobedience with death. That's what he has to do. And here we have these three men who, from the previous chapter, we find out that they're actually the rulers of Babylon. You remember in the previous chapter, if you've read it, if not, you can go read it. But Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and Daniel came and interpreted that dream. He came and told him what the dream was, and then he interpreted the dream for him. And Nebuchadnezzar was amazed, and he wanted to put Daniel in charge of Babylon, like the province of Babylon. And Daniel said, no, can I put these three men in charge? Would you do that? So Nebuchadnezzar made Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be the rulers of the province of Babylon. So how much more then would his insecurity be busting at the seams because he has these foreign-born men who will not bow down to his idol, and he absolutely has to have unqualified obedience because he's terrified that he's going to be overthrown by somebody? Does that sound like freedom? And here's the other thing about insecurity. It not only produces terror or fear, but there's a two-sided coin with insecurity. The other side of the coin is actually arrogance. You got to put yourself forward. Like it's like the MMA fighters. And I don't watch that because it's violent. And, you know, I don't know anything about any of the moves that they make on each other. And I'm only referring to it because it's evil. I'm teasing for anybody that's new here. I'm just messing with you. But it's, what was I going to say? I got off on it. I was going to tell something really good about it, and I can't remember what it was. The two-sided coin. Oh, when they have the pre-fight thing and they stand next to each other, and of course, I've never seen it, but they stand next to each other right in their noses, you know, and they talk about each other like they're going to beat them up. They're going to, and I don't know what's going on inside of them. Some I actually believe they will. But I got to think that some are terrified. I would be terrified inside. There's this insecurity and this arrogance are two sides of the same coin. They've got to be. And we have that here at the end of verse 15. And who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands? This is all coming from fear, right? You got to back big. If you act big, then maybe they'll back down. Does that sound like freedom to you? He doesn't seem very free to me. He can do whatever he wants, but he's not acting according to who he was built to be. We were built to love and serve God. That's when we're truly free. Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians, now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. There is freedom. Is freedom from God? Is it freedom from God? This is what people want. Do away with all restraint, anything that's shackling me, including God, nothing to do with him. Christianity is saying the opposite. It's freedom to lean in. It is freedom to follow. Yeah, it's freedom to obey God, to do what he wants us to do, to be who we were built to be. See, negative freedom, the negative freedom of the Enlightenment is no freedom at all. It's no freedom at all. If you try to learn another language, are you not... You're really not free until you learn a mess of vocabulary and you learn the rules of the language and you can start getting facility with it, then you can say anything you want. You have absolute freedom, but you can't go off and talk gibberish. Nobody will understand what you're talking about. You got to stay within the rules of the language. You're absolutely free when you're using the rules, right? It's like a fish who's out on the land. They're not free. They are only free when they're in the water and they're swimming in their natural habitat. If they go out of the water, they can't. I'm going to do away with the restraint of water. I'm not going to be in water anymore. And so they're out on the land. They're dying, right? But in the water, what they were built for, they're free. This is the difference between negative freedom and positive freedom. The negative freedom of the Enlightenment doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. We're destroying ourselves. We're destroying ourselves. Nebuchadnezzar's a slave to his passion. And so here's my question. What are you a slave to this morning? What are you a slave to this morning? What makes you angry? Or what causes you fear? These are the things that you're enslaved to. Real freedom is to be the one you were built to be. That's the first point. Number two, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their freedom. What's astounding to me about these men is their peace, their freedom, and I'm equating that with peace. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's also the fruit of the Spirit. And one of the big ones is peace. So you could say, you could almost use these terms synonymously. Where there is freedom, there really is peace. So these men are not uptight. They're brought before the king, and he threatens them with immediate death if they don't comply. This is a do or die for the king, of course. It's a do or die. His kingdom is at stake. That some of his rulers that he's elevated are not bowing down to the God he said should be bowed down. It's a do or die for him. He has to punish this kind of public rebellion or he might lose control of his kingdom. And he threatens them and he gets arrogant with them. Who is this God that will deliver you out of my hands? And I would have been terrified. But listen to their speech, verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Basically, King Nebuchadnezzar, the answer is no. Can you imagine saying no to the totalitarian ruler who has your life in his hands? Ish. It's really in God's hands. That's the whole point of the book of Daniel, right? That God controls Nebuchadnezzar. He's over Nebuchadnezzar. That's the whole point. But no, the answer is no. Where did they get that kind of freedom to say no? See, this is the essence of what positive freedom looks like. They knew what was what. What do I mean by that? This comes from an unnamed pastor. Think of the solar system. A solar system is only a system because all the planets agree, if you will, that there is only one center and all the rest of them orbit. All the rest of them center on that center. That's why it's a system. But imagine if every planet said, no, I'm going to be the center of the universe. If every planet got stationary and used all of its gravitational pull to get everything else to revolve around them, if everyone insists that everyone and everything revolve around them, you don't have a solar system anymore. You have a cataclysm. You have worlds colliding, a cosmic car wreck. So what's the difference here between Nebuchadnezzar and these three men? Well, Nebuchadnezzar is a planet that is trying to get other planets to revolve around him, and he's doing it by force. He has tremendous force at his disposal, and he will wipe out anybody that gets in his way. He is the little planet that is trying to pull everybody to revolve around him. And it's not working. These three men know that they are planets that revolve around the sun. They are not engaging in behavior to save themselves. They are not worried about themselves at all. They are not thinking about themselves. They are completely free in the situation that they're in because they know who is at the center of the solar system. They know that God is in charge, and Nebuchadnezzar can't change that. No matter what threats are given, Nebuchadnezzar is not the center of the universe. He thinks he's in charge, so he flies into a rage when they won't listen to him, but they don't care if he throws them into the fiery furnace. They know that God can deliver them, but even if he doesn't, he will still deliver them after death. In other words, they don't care about their deaths. This is the same thing I shared with you last week about Viktor Frankl in the concentration camp. Those who had nothing important that the camp could take away were those that could live heroically. In other words, those who had not put their hope on their families or on their money or on all the things that the camp took away, those that had put their hope on something outside the camp, on God himself, were the ones that could live heroically. Take away what you want from me. Take my life. Take my possessions. Take everything. It doesn't make any difference. God's in charge of my life. He built me to be someone who follows him, who goes after him. So who's truly free here? Is Nebuchadnezzar free? Or is it actually Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? And I ask you the same thing. How free are you? What are you holding on to that you so desperately need that is making you anxious, fearful, that is making you angry? What are the things you're holding on to? If it's anything in this world, it can be taken away, and it very likely might be at some point. If you're hanging on that way, you're in trouble. We always have things pressing around us. See, consider the man that loves ice cream and loves salt on his food and loves junk food. But he goes to the cardiologist, and the cardiologist says to him that if he keeps eating like he is, he will be dead in 2 years. What is freedom in this case? If freedom is defined as a doing away with all restraints, he can continue to eat the junk food and be dead in 2 years, or he can decide that he wants to live longer and restrain himself from the junk food. Do you see how confusing it is when it's getting rid of all restraints? You can't get rid of all restraints. It's an impossibility. It's a physical, philosophical, any way you look at it, it's an impossibility to get rid of all restraints. See, life is full of choices. And negative freedom creates expectations. And brothers and sisters, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. These men are under no illusions. They will follow their God. That's what they were built for, and they are willing to suffer. Do you realize that negative freedom and suffering are incompatible? It's one of the reasons people want negative freedom, because they want to be free of all suffering. They will go away from anything that causes any kind of suffering. I think we've been influenced by this. We're afraid of suffering as well. So one of the basic tenets of freedom is that all restraints are gone. Do whatever you have to do not to suffer. But that's not freedom, because suffering is part and parcel of our lives. Everybody's suffering. You either have suffered, you are suffering, or you're about to. It's always, this is the way it works. So the question is, what are you going to do with that suffering? Well, these men put their hope in God, knowing that he would deliver them either in this life or the next. Now, that's freedom. That's freedom. So Nebuchadnezzar is furious. He turns the heat up 7 times, so hot that the people that throw them into the furnace die because they can't even get near it. I'm not sure how you do that. I'm not sure how you get it that hot. They had their ways, obviously. And so what happened? So if you want to have freedom, this is what we need to see. Jesus showed up. Jesus showed up. Verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire? And they answered and said to the king, true, O king. He answered and said, but I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods. He's talking about Jesus. This is one of Jesus' pre-incarnate appearances in the Old Testament. See, this is the thing about Jesus. He comes over and over and over and over again to rescue his own. We have no ability to be who we were built to be because of the sin that plagues the world. We will always choose to use our gravitational pull to make ourselves the center of our universe, to get people to talk about us, to get people to like us, to get people to want to be with us, to do whatever we have to do to adjust our behavior, to get people to come around us so that we're not lonely and we're not away from people or whatever it is. This is what we do. This is our natural tendency to use our gravitational pull to try to do that. But then Jesus shows up. So though he is, and he was then, and he is now, the center of the universe, he came not for himself, but for others. He came into the least likely place in all of the kingdom of Babylon. He shows up in a fiery furnace. What? Can you believe that? But look at the fiery furnace. It's really just a foreshadowing, isn't it? It's just a foreshadowing of the fact that he would suffer hell for us, that he would come to a cross and he would die on a cross for us, because we are isolated planets trying to get the sun to revolve around us. And instead of destroying us, he comes and he dies for us. What kind of a God is this? Does this sound like an intolerant bigot? I assure you, if he were, we wouldn't all even be alive today. No, he sends his son to die for us. In the book Life of Pi by Jan Martel, the main character is exploring religions. And at one point, he's leaning toward Hinduism, and he starts to talk to a Roman Catholic priest. And he starts to tell the character or the narrator about Jesus and about the death of Jesus on the cross. And he freaks out. This is what he says. That a god should put up with adversity, I could understand. The gods of Hinduism face their fair share of thieves, bullies, kidnappers, and usurpers. What is the Ramayana but the account of one long bad day for Rama? Adversity, yes. Reversals of fortune, yes. Treachery, yes, but humiliation? Death? I couldn't imagine Lord Krishna consenting to be stripped naked, whipped, mocked, dragged through the streets, and to top it off, crucified, and at the hands of mere humans to boot. I'd never heard of a Hindu god dying, but divinity should not be blighted by death. It's wrong. It was wrong for this Christian god to let his avatar die. That is tantamount to letting a part of himself die. For if the son is to die, it cannot be fake. If God on the cross is God shamming, which means to be a sham, shamming a human tragedy, it turns the passion of Christ into the farce of Christ. The death of the Son must be real. Father Martin assured me that it was. But once a dead God, always a dead God, even resurrected. He says the Son must have the taste of death forever in his mouth. The Trinity must be tainted by it. There must be the certain stench at the right hand of God the Father. The horror must be real. Why would God wish that upon himself? Why not leave death to the mortals? Why make dirty what is beautiful, spoil what is perfect? And the priest says, love, pure love. That's the answer. A God who loves us and would give everything for us. See, brothers and sisters, his wounds that he will carry for eternity, and he will carry them for eternity, is a reminder to us of his love. So because it is his love that frees us to be who we were created to be, we orbit around him. We follow him. We give him our lives, just as he gave his life for us and came to serve us. That's true freedom. And that's the gospel. And it changes everything. Let's pray.